This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Monday, the 17th of June, these are our main stories. A peace summit on Ukraine has closed with the reaffirmation of the country's territorial integrity. But some attending nations who've maintained close ties with Moscow didn't sign the communique. A jihadist group has claimed it killed dozens of soldiers in an attack in Burkina Faso this month, which the military authorities haven't acknowledged. Another tourist has been found dead in Greece, which is suffering an extreme heat wave. Also in this podcast, we head to Scotland, where we meet the hoof trimmer who's become a surprise internet star. If there were any doubts about whether Ukraine would be giving up territory in the hope of peace, those doubts seem to have been put to rest. It was something that had been suggested by Russia, but at the end of a peace summit in Switzerland, world leaders have ruled out expecting Ukraine to surrender land. Ursula von der Leyen is the European Commission President.
I call on Russia to heed the message of the international community, respect the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Ukraine, put an end to imperialist violence, and bring back the children.
But speaking at the same news conference, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky said achieving swift peace was a priority.
We are at a war, and we don't have time for prolonged war. Moving to peace means acting fast. Preparations will take months, not years. So, when the action plans for peace are ready, and when every step is worked out, the path will be opened for the second peace summit, and thus for ending this war, for a just and lasting peace.
I asked Sarah Rainsford, who was at the summit, just how successful, if at all, it had been.
Well, according to Mr. Zelensky, very successful. He called it a great success. He stressed that 84 countries who had delegations here joined a joint communique which underlined Ukraine's right essentially not to be invaded and called for things such as an increase in prisoner exchanges, called for nuclear security, called for food security, all issues that the delegations here could talk about, could discuss and could essentially agree upon. But there were a handful of countries, including Saudi Arabia, India, Mexico, who didn't sign up to that final communique. And of course, the big missing part in all of this was not only Russia, but its big backer, China, who shunned these talks, essentially after pressure from Moscow. So I think this was an important first step. Certainly, Ukraine and its Western backers, and now other countries, are trying to move towards a possible path to peace. Ukraine seizing the initiative on that, but it is going to be a long and very complex path. And Russia, of course, is still prosecuting its war.
Yeah, indeed. And the Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, has said, look, we're open for peace. And as far as Ukraine is concerned, the conditions for them will get worse as time goes on. What's going to change, if anything, between now and this second peace summit, do you think, to make things better for Ukraine?
Well, I think it's important to say, first of all, that you know Russia's saying it's open for peace, but in fact it's calling for the full capitulation of Ukraine. So when Vladimir Putin talks about a peace proposal, what he's actually saying is withdraw from your own territory, Ukraine. So I think, you know, it's quite clear that Kiev has dismissed those suggestions as absurd. And that's why Ukraine, I think, is trying to push its own initiative and trying to get the broadest possible international alliance behind it. So it's going to be a work in progress. They are aiming for a second leaders' summit where Russia could be brought to the same table. But I think, you know, that's a fair old way off. At the moment, we're nowhere near that.
Sarah, obviously keeping America on board is key to success for Ukraine. It's going to be very difficult, isn't it? Because come November, it could be Mr. Trump in the White House, and that will paint a very different picture for Ukraine.
Potentially, yeah. I mean, of course, Donald Trump has said if he were to return to the presidency, he'd end this war in 24 hours. What that means, nobody really knows. There's so much uncertainty. And I think that is the important context for what's happening here. But certainly at this point, America is still supporting Ukraine militarily, although Mr. Zelensky talked about that today and talked about the fact that Western support is coming through, but it's coming through too slowly. It's not enough. He says, you know, Ukraine is committed to still fighting on the battlefield, but this is a parallel process for peace.
Sarah Rainsford. Next to Burkina Faso, an al-Qaeda affiliate says it was behind a recent attack in the northeast of the country and claims that dozens of soldiers were killed. Video footage posted on social media shows last Tuesday's raid on the town of Mansilla near the border with Niger. The military government hasn't commented on the incident. There are reports that many civilians are missing following the attack. I heard more from our Africa editor, Will Ross.
Well, the video posted by the al-Qaeda-linked JNIM group shows a large amount of weaponry and ammunition that it says were captured during this attack on Mansilla. It also, you know, is confirming or saying that it was behind this raid. And there have in recent days been some videos showing basically young men on motorbikes, and then the sound of sort of relentless gunfire that seems to be sort of aimed at some of the compounds, which are made up of mud-walled buildings, and that they're kind of hiding behind some of the walls and shooting. But it is relentless shooting, and we understand that that is also footage taken from Mansilla, although that's yet to be confirmed. And some civilians in the area have talked about a lot of people killed, both military and civilians, and a large number of people missing.
And Will, you mentioned the JNIM group. What do we know about that group and the impact they're having on people across Burkina Faso?
Well, that particular group's been around for about 6 or 7 years, and it was formed when other groups came together. But it's one of several jihadist groups, some linked to al-Qaeda, some linked to the Islamic State, and they're basically moving across the borders between Mali, Burkina Faso and Niger, and attacking what are very vulnerable villages in remote areas, especially near where those three countries meet.
Now, Will, the generals are in charge at the moment. It's a military government. They kicked out French troops that were helping because they didn't want them anymore. But that doesn't seem to be working, does it?
Yeah, I mean, the security situation is pretty grim at the moment. There have been a number of attacks on the military, significant ones. And Captain Ibrahim Traoré, who's been in power now for nearly 2 years, he just last month announced that he'd be staying there for another five. And really the main reason that he and his coup plotters gave for carrying out what was the second coup in just a few months was mostly because of all the insecurity and the failure of the previous governments, the military one and then the civilian ones before that, to deal with this jihadist insurgency.
Will Ross. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has described the introduction of daily tactical pauses in military activity in part of southern Gaza as unacceptable. The move, intended to allow more aid to reach the strip, was announced by the Israeli military earlier on Sunday. The army is said to have reassured Mr. Netanyahu that the 11-hour daytime pauses between 8 a.m. and 7 p.m. every day only apply to the road that leads northwards from the Kerem Shalom crossing, and that fighting in Rafah would continue. Well, the Prime Minister has come under strong pressure from far-right members of his coalition government to reject any pauses in the conflict until Hamas is totally defeated. I spoke to our correspondent John Donaldson in Jerusalem and started by asking him, what exactly do we know about this IDF announcement on Sunday?
Well, certainly we've been getting pretty mixed messages from both the Israeli military and the Israeli government today. It started this morning with an announcement from the IDF that they were going to be introducing a daily tactical military pause to allow more aid in through the Kerem Shalom crossing from Israel into Gaza, which is right in the south of the Gaza Strip, very close to Rafah. However, very quickly, we then had comments from Israel's hardline right-wing national security minister, Itamar Ben-Gavir, saying that anyone who'd made that sort of decision was both evil and a fool. And within an hour or so, we then had a clarifying statement from the IDF saying that there would be no cessation of violence in Rafah or in southern Gaza. So it's pretty difficult to see whether there's going to be any sort of change on the ground. We're going to have to wait and see. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said this evening that any sort of tactical pause in hostilities is unacceptable. We've spoken to the United Nations. They say they cautiously welcome the move, but they want to see whether it really has any effect on the ground. And I think it's an indication, really, of the discord between the Israeli military and some of the Israeli government.
And John, given what you know about the geography of that part of Gaza, if there was some kind of tactical military pause, what difference might it make to the amount of aid that gets in?
Kerem Shalom Crossing is very, very close to Rafah, where Israel is focusing its military operation at the moment. So there is a road that goes in. It joins up with the Salah al-Din road, which runs north to south in Gaza and is the main road along the coast that allows people to access northern Gaza. So I guess if there was a decrease in hostilities specifically on that road, it might allow aid agencies to operate more freely. But there's no sign that Israel's military operation in Rafah is stopping. So we're just going to have to wait and see. What Israel says is that it is allowing a substantial number of trucks into Gaza every day, some 200 trucks. But there is a problem with them being picked up on the other side by the aid agencies and then distributed around Gaza. And that's because the aid agencies say it's simply too dangerous.
John Donison. Well, as we just heard, fighting is expected to continue around the city of Rafah in Gaza south. It's where Israel says Hamas's last major stronghold is based, but also where large numbers of displaced Palestinians are still sheltering. UNICEF's James Elder is now in Rafah. He spoke to the BBC's Lise Doucette.
No one should be surprised at how much worse things have got, of course, when there is a relentless bombardment and aid restrictions and denials, and now the heat. We shouldn't be surprised, but we should be woefully alarmed. So I think for me, at least to come back and see scenes in hospitals of walking over children on floor with missing limbs and with grave head injuries and not yet getting the care they need because doctors are utterly swamped. It felt like the first month of the war again. So I think that has certainly been a startling sense amid what is worryingly becoming almost a normalization of this, a normalization of the attacks, of the carnage, of the children living in constant fear.
As you may have been hearing, there's confusion this morning about whether or not the Israeli military is going to have what they called a tactical pause. It does seem that there may have been a decision to allow for calm along the key corridor and the Salah al-Din road toward the Kerem Shalom crossing to allow the trucks to move unhindered. If that is the case, would that help much?
Look, in one sense, in the most simple sense, I think any pause, lease in bombardments is good for children. Here where I am in Rafah and border of Khan Yunis, the last three nights have been relentless. I thought I knew what the sound of nearby bombardments was. I had no idea. It's like someone beating pots and pans next to your head. So beyond the obvious physical threat to children is just the psychological sense, the impossibility of sleeping. And if it's not that, it's drones. It's a lawnmower above your head. Now I'm talking about a couple of nights. We're talking about 250 nights. Any pause in bombardments is good. And we need much better conditions to bring aid in and to safely deliver that aid inside the Gaza Strip. So we need enhanced security and improved access. And remembering, these aren't pie-in-the-sky ideas. Israel, as the occupying power, has a legal responsibility to facilitate on the ground to ensure that it's not as chaotic as we're now finding it. So we need that safety, we need more aid, and as we've been saying for months and months, we need more entry routes to come in.
That was James Elder. An Iranian convicted in Sweden of war crimes has been freed as part of a prisoner swap between the two countries. Hamid Nouri, who was serving a life sentence, has returned to Tehran in exchange for the Swedish diplomat Johan Floderus and the dual national Said Azizi, who arrived home in Stockholm late on Saturday. Iran has often been accused of hostage diplomacy. There have been other exchanges of dual nationals and foreigners in Tehran for Iranians jailed abroad, as well as other concessions sought by Tehran. Well, Lise Doucette spoke to the BBC Persian correspondent Sirvash Ardalan and asked him first for more on Hamid Nouri.
Hamid Nouri was the assistant to the deputy prosecutor of Iran back in the 80s. This was a time of war and political turmoil inside the country. He had been accused of being involved in the mass killing of political prisoners in 1987. It was a very bloody episode in Iranian history. It resonates very strongly with Iranian expatriates. So they were always trying to find a way to either get him or anyone else who was involved in those killings, particularly Ebrahim Raisi, the former president of Iran, who recently died in a helicopter crash, somehow to be held accountable in some sort of an international forum. So when he traveled to Sweden, when they lured him to Sweden and the Swedish police arrested him and they put him on trial, they felt like they had their day. And it took weeks and weeks of testimonies, which brought some measure of closure for the victims. And Hamid Nouri himself was there trying to defend his actions.
And what about the Swedish diplomat, Johan Floderus, Said Azizi, any evidence that they were indeed, as Iran can charge them with, spying?
Well, if there is any evidence, none was presented because all these cases are held behind closed doors and we really don't know what Iran's evidence were. Hostage diplomacy is something that Iran has been known to be involved in. It's part of its playbook. A lot of people, dual nationals, dozens of them, are languishing in Iranian jails, are being held as bargaining chips. So this seemed to be the latest case in that episode.
And one was left behind. Any more details about what was the discussions around this one, why this one happened and another didn't?
Well, there are five Swedish nationals who are being held in Iran. Two were swapped with this. And that has become the focus of a lot of criticism by the Swedish media. Why just these two and not one of the most high profile cases, which is Ahmad Reza Jalali, another dual citizen who had been arrested 7 years ago on charges of espionage and has been convicted and has received a death sentence. So he's on a death row. His family weren't informed. And a lot of people are asking, well, he was the most high-profile case and he was on a death row. Why wasn't he part of that prisoner swap? To which the Swedish prime minister replied that the Iranians refused to even consider his case.
Now, Sivash Ardalan from BBC Persian. Now, if watching the news programme showing conflict or even the football matches in the European Championships is going to be too stressful, how about tuning into a very different type of content? One man in Scotland has built up a huge online following by filming his day job. Keris Maidment reports.
From pimple popping to power washing, the internet is full of oddly satisfying content. And for one man in Scotland, posting up close and personal videos of his job is earning him up to 170 million views a month.
Welcome to the Hoof GP and a cow with an extremely sore back left foot that becomes very obvious after the very first swipe of the grinder.
Graham Parker, otherwise known as the Hoof GP, is a professional hoof trimmer working across cattle farms in the area. From pus splats to huge ulcers, no effort is spared when it comes to relieving animals of their sore and clogged feet.
So as I picked this cow's foot up, it instantly started to ooze all of this fluid out of the sole of it.
Starting off 5 years ago as a way to share his technique with local farmers, his audience rapidly grew, with subscribers both in and outside the industry.
Every single day of the week, people are contacting us to ask how to do this or how to do that, how we can help them, or just to say how we've kind of helped them in their lives, even although they're not in agriculture, which is something I never expected to happen, but has been a really humbling and incredibly kind of endearing thing that has happened.
From the audience's reaction, it seems to be a mix of fascination with his craft and his care for animals that keeps them watching. One YouTube user said, "If you would have told me 3 weeks ago that watching cows get their hooves repaired would make my life better, I would have laughed in your face. Well, here we are today, and I love it." Others have reported looking more closely at cows in fields on their commutes to work, or just a growth in their general compassion for animals, all thanks to his videos. And for some, they've even found transferable skills in Graham's content. One user commented, "Strangely, I find myself peeling potatoes differently now." But despite the fame and 6.8 million subscribers across the social media platforms, it's still just a side hustle to his one true passion.
Things have got quite big, but I'm still a hoof trimmer who hoof trims, and that is my job.
That report was by Keris Maidment. Still to come.
It's the most famous dance floor in film history, and where John Travolta displayed his now legendary moves to a Bee Gees disco soundtrack.
Now, the original 1970s film prop has been auctioned off alongside other items from such classics as Indiana Jones, Harry Potter, and Star Wars. This is the Global News Podcast. Another foreign tourist has been found dead in Greece, which is suffering its earliest seasonal heatwave on record, with temperatures pushing 40 degrees. Here's Sasha Slichter.
The body of the 55-year-old American was spotted floating in the sea off the island of Corfu. He was last seen alive on Thursday. It's just the latest of tourist deaths on Greece's islands. The most high profile was that of the BBC presenter and health author Michael Mosley. He'd set out in blistering temperatures on a walk that would turn fatal when, after taking a wrong route, he ended up climbing rugged hills. Several more tourists are still missing.
Sasha Slichter. We're staying with extreme weather, and Sunday was another hot day in a large swathe of the central and southern parts of the United States, with temperatures in some areas soaring into the 90 degrees Fahrenheit and higher. That's above 32 degrees Celsius. It's called a heat dome, a massive high-pressure system, which is expected to build over the east and stretch into the Midwest and Great Lakes over the next few days. In the US, heat kills more than twice as many people each year on average as hurricanes and tornadoes combined. Lise Doucette heard more from Jolene Russell, a professor of geosciences at the University of Arizona in Tucson, where they've been sitting under this particular heat dome for some time.
We are on our 18th day of temperatures above 100 degrees Fahrenheit, 38 degrees Celsius. It means that we're walking our dogs at 5 in the morning because otherwise they burn their feet. It means we have to get our kids outside to play or to ride their bikes early in the morning or late in the evening because the only time it's safe is when the sun's not up.
Explain to us what the difference is between intense heat and a heat dome.
Well, a heat wave, our National Weather Service here in the U.S. defines it as a period of unusually hot weather that typically lasts 2 days or more. But a heat dome is a big, stagnant, high-pressure system. Think several states wide, hundreds of kilometers in the upper parts of the atmosphere that allows heat to build underneath over multiple days. It's created when the jet stream, which we share with you in the U.K., you guys are rainy and gray, I understand. My parents who live in northern Montana, right on the Canadian border, are also rainy and gray because the jet stream is overhead there. But what that's allowed to happen is an enormous dome of very warm, very dry air has been sitting over the southwest of the United States for 18 days. It's now starting to move towards our Midwest and into the east and our Great Lakes area, and they are going to be suffering some spectacularly high temperatures for them.
And I understand that in some areas they're different. Some are dry, which I understand is the case in Arizona, and some are humid.
Yes, as we move towards Texas, near the Gulf of Mexico, you have incredibly humid air stretching all the way from the Gulf of Mexico up to our Great Lakes on the Canadian border. And all of that humidity actually puts more pressure on people. It means that not only are the temperatures hotter than average, they're also more humid, which means your heat index feels even higher. And it's more dangerous because it does not cool off as much at night. It's very dangerous.
Professor Jolene Russell in Arizona. Next to Germany, and at the Men's European Football Championship, England beat Serbia 1-0. Jude Bellingham scored the only goal in the first half. Ahead of the match on Sunday in the German city of Gelsenkirchen, police said there'd been an altercation involving fans from the two teams. 7 Serbian nationals were taken into custody and the groups were separated. In the day's other games, Denmark and Slovenia drew 1-1, and the Netherlands beat Poland 2-1. But England fans were jubilant about the outcome of their game. That was the scene here at a fan zone in London when England scored their only goal against Serbia. BBC Sports' Andy Barwell told me more.
England were in control for the first 35 minutes of this game, but the rest of the match not so. Serbia more than matched a side who were considered to be one of the favourites to win this entire tournament. Just the one goal settled the game. It came on 13 minutes from Jude Bellingham, who's had such an excellent season for Real Madrid. A header gave England the lead then in the game, and that's the way it finished. Harry Kane had a good effort in the second half, denied by the goalkeeper, and the England goalkeeper Jordan Pickford saved well from Dusan Vlahovic. But in the end, England held on. Rather nervous, slow starters, England certainly lacked a bit of a spark in this game.
And earlier in the day, there was a particularly poignant moment for Denmark's Christian Eriksen.
Yes, there was a memorable return for him to the European Championship. If you remember, 3 years ago, he suffered a cardiac arrest on the pitch during their opening game at that European Championship in the match against Finland at the previous tournament. But he's back playing again. A Manchester United player, didn't really play much for his club last season in the Premier League, but was on target with a goal for Denmark today as they drew one apiece in a game with Slovenia. And the day's other match was in Group D. It was Poland 1, Netherlands 2. Wout Weghorst was the winning goal scorer there for the Netherlands. 83 minutes. He'd only been on the pitch for 2 minutes. A substitution, a very direct, old-fashioned style of centre-forward. Good decision there, that substitution made by the Dutch boss, Ronald Koeman.
And Andy, just give us an idea about the main matches tomorrow.
We've got two matches in Group E, Ukraine against Romania and Belgium against Slovakia. Now, Belgium have always seemed to underperform at these major championships. Could this be the time when it comes right for them? And then in the late kickoff tomorrow, back to Group D, and it's France against Austria. Kylian Mbappe is the skipper for the French team in this game, one of the world's best strikers, and he says he can't wait to get started.
Andy Barwell, and as Andy was saying there, Kylian Mbappe will lead the French national team out in their opening game on Monday. But on Sunday, as France prepares for parliamentary elections at the end of the month, the French captain made a political intervention, as we heard from the sports journalist Emily Herbert.
He's called on the French public today to kind of vote against extremes, as he calls it, in their general election at the end of June. And he's essentially urging young people to vote. It comes after his teammate Marcus Thuram expressed concerns about the rise of their country's right-wing populist party. And when Mbappe was asked about it in the press conference, he said that he supports his teammate and it's freedom of speech and that he's on his side. And as captain, I guess there is that kind of responsibility to protect his team, protect his players. But he further reiterated that there might be a lot of young people who are not conscious about the importance and the urgency of their situation. And when you look at the numbers, like the young numbers voting in the countryside and the suburbs, it's significantly low. So, but it's always, you know, politics and sport, it's always a sensitive and difficult topic, isn't it? Whether it's their responsibility or not. But when you look at the audience and the young audience that listens to him and his team, it's huge. And so he's using his stage to try and encourage young voters.
Emily Herbert. Generations of dad dancers have imagined they were on it, the original dance floor, where the American actor John Travolta danced in the 70s film Saturday Night Fever. Now, it's sold at auction for the equivalent of more than $300,000. It was auctioned off alongside props from films including Indiana Jones, Harry Potter and Star Wars. Our correspondent Charlotte Gallagher reports.
It's the most famous dance floor in film history and where John Travolta displayed his now legendary moves to a Bee Gees disco soundtrack. The prop was built for Saturday Night Fever in 1977 and remained in the nightclub in Brooklyn where the movie was filmed until 2005. The auction house admitted some of the original panels had become opaque with age and had a yellowish hue. The dance floor is also in six parts, so will need to be reassembled by whoever has bought it.
The army which carries the Ark before it is invincible.
The Ark, it is their TARDIS.
An Ark of the Covenant prototype used in the making of the Indiana Jones film Raiders of the Lost Ark made more than $100,000 at the auction. A replica hoverboard from Back to the Future Part 2 sold for $6,500, while the yellow boxing boots worn by Sylvester Stallone in Rocky 3 were bought for $26,000. Even a single casino chip from the James Bond film Dr. No fetched $1,000.
That report by Charlotte Gallagher. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics that we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.